Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, it is Documentary Week. Every year, we do AFI docs, usually in person at big gala events downtown at the museum. And not only is there no more a museum, we're not going in person this year, just like last year. We're going in virtuo.
Yes, even though they are having this hybrid back at the AFI Docs Theater. We're at the AFI Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland, where it all began. So for some people, this will be an opportunity to kind of revisit how the AFI Docs really grew and what it grew from.
Now, in years past, I know it was more challenging for our audience to connect with this particular episode because the documentaries, these are award seekers. They come out in the fall. They come out next year. They're looking for Oscars, but not this year. I'm sure they're still looking for Oscars. But most of them, I think the vast majority of them, are backed by Netflix, PBS, HBO Max, and they're going to come out soon. In fact, two of them are already out. Mm-hmm. The rest are coming out this month, next month, August. What we're going to talk about, you're going to be able to see them soon, which is a great way to connect with documentary. You don't have to wait and you think, oh, did they talk about that 10 months ago? I'm not going to run into that problem this time around. Mm-hmm. So last night, two nights ago, they did the opening gala. And this is usually a big deal. We dress up. I wear a tie, maybe a jacket. There's a bar. People hobnob. We rub elbows. Mm-hmm. This year, even if we were in person, the opening night film choice would have felt off. It's not a full feature-length documentary film. It is episode one of a docuseries. Yeah. Episode one of three, which will be premiering on Netflix starting on 13 July, so actually just a couple weeks from now, you'll be able to see Naomi Osaka. Wait a minute, I've heard that name, you say. Yes, she's been in the news. And I checked. I went back and I checked the dates, Hannah, because maybe did they choose this film because she's in the news? It's timely. Throw her in there. AFI Docs announced there that Naomi Osaka would be the opening film on 26 May. Mm-hmm. She withdrew from the French Open on 31 May. So they didn't do it.
I didn't think. I was not nearly as cynical as you were about that. I actually thought, wow, they lucked out with the timing, because when she withdrew and has been in the news and people are sort of more aware of the issues that she's facing and her mental health status and all of that, I think that gives this particular opening a boost. But you are right. If this had been any other year, and if Naomi Osaka were not in the news, this would have been, I think, a pretty poor choice for an opening night. It just didn't hook the viewer. It didn't grab me in any real way.
The other possible reason I can divine about why they would make such a radical, sharp left turn on opening night selections is the director. It's directed by Garrett Bradley. She was just nominated for an Oscar. We just saw her on TV sitting in the train station with everyone else. She was nominated for Time. If you haven't seen that yet, it's still on Amazon Prime Video. Fine documentary. And I wonder if, since they have a film from a very recent Oscar nominee, if that's why they did it.
That could be part of it. I didn't love Time. I thought it was decent. But again, it was the kind of thing that I felt like I'd seen before. Certainly the theme was there before. When we've seen some really, really, really good sports documentaries over the years at AFI Docs, this one to me just did not measure up.
This, it does have sports backing star power. It's executive produced by LeBron James and comes from his production company. But I see what you're saying about it not hitting, it not connecting. And I don't know if that's just because it's episode one or how the director framed it. It's so spacey. There's no talking head interviews. There's no, like, Q&A. You don't learn very many Naomi Osaka facts at all. If you don't know who she is going into this, you still won't know who she is. Bradley wants to pass on feelings. You know, Osaka is clearly insecure. She is very uncertain of her place in time, her place in things, her place in tennis. She looks awkward walking onto the court. And, you know, Bradley, she had no idea what was coming. She did not know the French Open thing was going to happen. She did not know Osaka was also going to decline Wimbledon. The film focuses on 2019's U.S. Open. Osaka won 2018, that infamous match where Serena Williams almost got in a fight with the chair umpire. That's the one Osaka won. 2019, she's defending her title for the first time. So what's the mood of this film? I guess it's from the heart. You know, she gives real, honest answers to these press conference questions, and, you know, the reporters should appreciate that. They usually get these platitudes, you know, one play at a time, one game at a time, got to execute, coach. And she's really talking to them, and maybe she just can't handle that anymore.
Well, and it is. It's sort of considered, it's positioned as this intimate inside look at the pressures, both internal and external, that are facing this, you know, tennis superstar. And so I think it helps you understand better what her view is right now about doing media appearances and stuff, because she clearly is uncomfortable when you see her throughout this documentary talking to the press, doing these appearances, and she just wants to play tennis. You know, I think that's what it all boils down to. It's like, let me just focus on my tennis. The rest of this really shouldn't matter. But, you know, in this day and age, superstardom comes, and, you know, being a professional athlete, it comes with certain other obligations, with sponsors and with doing the media appearances. They are connected to the money that that they then make doing these tournaments. And so I kind of feel like there needs to be a balance somewhere. It's like, I appreciate where she's coming from. You don't want to to overexpose or push somebody who is going through some mental health issues. I appreciate her honesty about it, but it doesn't change the fact that I just felt that we got 40 minutes, one part of this story, and so I felt incomplete with what I was getting, and so I don't think that serves AFI Docs all that well. Even if it does potentially serve Naomi Osaka better, because I think people will empathize a little bit more with her, and her fans, tennis buffs, will certainly probably want to watch this docuseries. It's only three parts.
This is a very unwise choice to make the opening night film to AFI Docs. Mm-hmm. It was not a smart move, even if it was a bold one. I watched 9 films so far.
Oh my God.
The best one you can already watch. It's already out. It's on HBO Max right now, and it's called LFG. You already know what it stands for. I don't need to tell you.
Do you think everyone knows what it stands for? I didn't know.
Google it.
I know, but I did not know what it stood for.
You did not know?
Uh-uh.
I took one look at it and like, ooh, that's good. I knew exactly what it stood for.
And as soon as I heard them all say it, I'm glad they said it out loud and in full, you know, basically in its full title. But I was not aware, so I would say that that folks do need to Google it.
The directors follow a lawsuit filed by the United States Women's National Soccer Team against the United States Soccer Federation, their governing body. They allege unequal pay and gender discrimination. They are paid less than their male counterparts. We get the prime suspect for about half the film, Megan Rapinoe. She's the most famous woman on the team. She's by far the most visible, by far the most vocal. She's the one who goes on Good Morning America. She's the one who tells President Trump to, you know, certain things. She got him with a Twitter war with him, and, you know, in no uncertain terms, she said she was not going to attend the White House gathering for, like, winning the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
The other half of the film is a soccer player I'd never heard of. She's also a forward on the team, Jessica McDonald. Jessica McDonald is a single mother who had to take her infant to practice, leave him in on a stroller on the sideline so she could practice. She lives below the poverty line. You know, and I don't know if that's the Soccer Federation's fault or the NWSL's fault, you know, who she plays for in the regular season. It's somebody's fault. She lives below the poverty line, and she is a professional athlete representing the United States of America. So, you know, we begin with huge celebrations. They won the 2019 World Cup. The men didn't make the World Cup. Mm-hmm. And the men still make more, but, you know, then the Soccer Federation has their counter-argument, their counter-attacks, they fall on their face and paint themselves as the villain. And of course, they did not participate in this documentary. The Washington Post had a write-up today of, the LFG is so one-sided. It's so one-sided. Soccer Federation did not get their say, so you didn't learn about A, B, and C. Well, guess what?
They declined. That's what happens when you decline. Yeah, and so sure, all documentaries have a perspective. They all start with a point of view. And so this was always going to be the point of view of the women's soccer players. And the fact that the Federation didn't want to respond and take part, well, they missed the boat. They missed their chance. Their arguments are laid out to some degree in this film, but then they are quashed, each of their arguments. I get it. I understand, you know, the law was not necessarily on the women's side here. They're fighting the good fight. They're going to keep fighting. It was sort of very moneyballish trying to figure out, okay, so the guys actually didn't get paid more in total, but they played fewer games than the women did. And so there was a lot of math to follow in this. But the bottom line is that this was like the biggest fight since Title IX, you know, for some female equality and pay and recognition. And they did. They won the World Cup. I mean, it's like, oh my gosh, these women kicked butt and they got paid less than the men. That's really all it boils down to. And hopefully it will take just a bigger groundswell of support from across the entire professional athletic field for them to get what they're looking for. But they certainly make a really, really compelling argument. And I'll tell you, if I had to do a documentary, I'd want a Megan Rapinoe in there because she was just awesome. She's just an awesome talking head to have in the documentary. She's very genuine and funny and says what she thinks. And so I actually came out of this a bigger Megan Rapinoe fan for sure.
Megan Rapinoe is magnetic in this film. LFG should have opened the AFI Documentary Film Festival. The second best film I have seen so far is Storm Lake. We all know, it is common knowledge of the plight of small-town newspapers. There's a reason there's actually a term called news desert. There wasn't that term however many years ago. You grew up in the news. You're a journalist by trade. This probably ruffles your feathers more than anybody. But Storm Lake follows one of the remaining, struggling small-town newspapers and the methods the staff employs to stay relevant to their community. Storm Lake is a very small town in Iowa, rural western Iowa. They say it's halfway between Fort Dodge and Sioux Falls. Nobody knows where that is. It is yonder, folks. It is yonder. They're trying to pinch pennies, but they're also at the same time trying to ensure the continuation of a free press and direct democracy when it looks like the heavyweight in town, the power, who has the real power? Tyson's Food Chicken Company. Talk about someone who wields power in that town. We got the Iowa caucuses, the ups and downs with that. Everyone goes to Storm Lake to campaign. You get a lot of politicians in this film.
A lot of politicians.
And you get COVID and the labor of love that happened with that. What I took away, local news is integral. Even in a town as small as Storm Lake.
It's integral and it's dying and it probably will soon be dead. It's sad. It's a sad state of affairs. I have a friend in Georgia who became like a sort of a cultural icon, social media star when she just did the real boots on the ground local news coverage for a tiny paper in Georgia and broke some big news during the election cycle. And she then basically was fighting, you know, it's almost like you need GoFundMe campaigns for every potential local news outlet in order to survive. But I also saw what was happening. And I see it every day when you do expect to get your news for free. And so nothing frustrates me more than when I go click on a link to read an article and it says, you know, you don't have any, you must subscribe to read the rest of this. And so a lot of people move on. They don't care to subscribe. I think Facebook is hugely to blame and Twitter for the demise of small town newspapers. But I do, you know, I totally feel for these old school journalism types who just are passionate and dedicated, and understand that that local news is still important. It's true. They talked about how you need those really, really hyper-local papers for the birth announcements, the death announcements. People in their community, they want to know who got married, who died, who had a baby, all those kinds of things. And you lose all that when you lose these newspapers, in addition to losing people who really understand the community and are going to make sure that they fight for the community and fight for that First Amendment and get the facts out. So it's a double-edged sword with really wanting them to survive, but also realizing that that people are just really not inclined to pay for newspapers anymore. And the digital world has just kind of taken control. And it's tough. It's going to be really hard. But old school journalism types are going to love this movie. It's really going to resonate. And it's both sad and you just want to donate a few dollars to every single local paper across the country to keep them alive.
If I lived in Storm Lake, Iowa, I would subscribe to the local newspaper. I would, and I'd try to be their film critic.
Well, I subscribe to the Washington Post, you know, like I...
Well, as do I, but mm-hmm. it's not a small-town newspaper.
It's not, but a lot of the, you know, one of the smaller Baltimore papers folded. You look at... I was reminded when there was all the anniversary of the shooting at the Capitol Gazette in Annapolis, and you were reminded of that small newsroom and just that tight-knit group of people that were trying to get that local news out, and they still did, even in the midst of their own tragedy. And so those are the kinds of papers that really are in the crosshairs and are struggling. And I don't know how many will survive, but absolutely, I completely encourage people, if they read and they want, when I get an alumni magazine, the first thing I look at is the who died and who got awarded something. And so those are the most, important little tidbits that you won't get from major news outlets. So yes, if I got nothing else out of watching Storm Lake, it's that everyone should really, really try very hard to support their hyper-local journalism so that they really understand what's happening on the community level.
All right, we're going to ping-pong back and forth now. So I'll mention a highlight of what I saw, then you'll actually talk about films you saw that are like coming out in theaters this week and that are not part of the film festival. Fair enough?
Yep.
I saw two shorts, and the reason I watched them is because they're local. The first one takes place in Frederick, Maryland. I love going up to Frederick, Maryland. Mm-hmm. They have the best record stores in the area. It's like this little hippie town in the middle of rural Maryland. And it actually takes place at the Maryland School for the Deaf. You'll be able to see this July 1st on Netflix. Their football team, their deaf football team, had a 42-game win streak, even against hearing teams. They just had a way of working well together, so it makes you think about the pros and cons of playing silent football. Executive producer Peter Berg, Friday Night Lights,
Peter Berg.
Mm-hmm. We know Peter Berg. So, of course, it's about football. So, Peter Berg, football. These are typical high school kids. You know, I don't know if she likes me. Peer pressure, homecoming. They're just deaf. So, nice little short right there. Mm-hmm. The other one I saw is RIP T-shirts. Southeast D.C., Anacostia. You know, the crime rate is high. Murders happen frequently. They reference the little Micaiah murder that happened a few years ago. And the Karan Johnson murder. And every time there's a murder, you know, there's a vigil, there's a gathering, people go to these T-shirt stores and they get these rest in peace T-shirts with their name, their picture, maybe their birth dates, their death dates, maybe a picture they took off of Facebook of them and their buddy, and they make these RIP T-shirts. And, you know, it follows a guy who runs one of these. There's a mall in Southeast D.C. that has four T-shirt shops in it, and they're all doing good business, making RIP T-shirts. What does that mean? The murder rate is too high.
Yeah.
Yes, if they're all in business making these T-shirts, but it's a way. This is an interesting sociological, cultural way of grieving, of remembering the dead, of them going to the store and making shirts of their uncle who was just shot in the street, or that 8-year-old who was just murdered walking to the ice cream truck. And it's all in here, the grieving mom, the whole thing. So RIP T-shirts, a decent watch. You watched a real documentary this week, one that's actually coming on Amazon Prime Video about a musician we all love.
Mary J. Blige. And I didn't realize that I did love her as much as I now know that I do. It'll be on Amazon this week. So, I mean, hey, it's a great one to watch if you already are familiar with Mary J. Blige and her music. And it's a good one to watch if you kind of know her name, but weren't really aware of her backstory and who she is and what her music is. And so it's very revealing. It's interesting, inspiring. But it's like her fan base is like a therapy group. It's like they love Mary J. and they love her lyrics and they all identify with it. She's this singer, producer, and actress. She's been around for like over 25 years now. And this particular documentary, she basically narrates her own story here. She talks about battles with depression, mental health, abuse, drugs, overcoming all kinds of obstacles, how she did it. She's a real inspiration, but she is both vulnerable and incredibly courageous in what she's been through and what she's doing, and very strong themes throughout this documentary about women empowerment and survival. And so it will definitely make you pay a lot more attention to the lyrics of her songs, especially from 25 years ago. This is basically the anniversary of her most influential work, which was the My Life album, and she performs that live for the first time, you know, as the anniversary comes around. It's a solid documentary about a musician. We've seen a lot of them lately. You know, we had Pink, we had Notorious B.I.G., we had
Billie Eilish.
So this is, you know, this is another one. And I definitely went out of my way. Mary J. Blige is an executive producer on it, as is Diddy, Sean Combs. He's in it. But the other reason I watched it was my old Headline News colleague, Mark Ford, is also listed as an executive producer. He's been doing like Laguna Beach and Siesta Key, producing those TV shows. But he's actually done a lot of music, behind the music type stuff. So I was very impressed. I was glad, because there's nothing worse than knowing that somebody you know has worked on something and then you don't like it. But I felt this was actually very well put together and well paced.
I can't wait to watch this documentary this weekend. I guarantee you I'm going to watch it. I love Mary J. Blige. I was coming of age as a young teenager when she first hit. I identify with her throughout my lifetime. I make it a point when we do film festivals to always watch the music documentaries. Usually AFI Docs has two. Usually I have two. This year, the big one I haven't seen yet, but I plan on watching it this weekend, is the Tom Petty documentary. Yes. I seriously want to watch the Tom Petty one. I just haven't seen it yet. The next one I want to talk about is a woman we should know. We should know her, but nobody does, but they will now, because it's called My Name is Pauli Murray. This is opening in the fall for a theatrical release. This is directed by Julie Cohen and Betsy West. We know them because they did 2018's RBG. And while doing RBG, RBG started talking about Pauli Murray. And then director's like, who is that? And so when they dug in, did the research to find out who she was, they're like, that's it. That's our next film. Her name's not common knowledge. She was never referenced in any of my 20th century history books. But if there was a first, Pauli Murray most likely is responsible for it. In 1940, 15 years before Rosa Parks, Murray was arrested in Petersburg, Virginia, for refusing to move to the back of the bus. 1943, 17 years before the Woolworths lunch counter sit-ins, Murray helped desegregate DC's U Street by staging a sit-in. She applied to the University of North Carolina before they admitted black students. She was the only female in her Howard University Law School class. She was the first black woman ordained as an Episcopal priest. She wrote a paper describing the arguments used to strike down Plessy versus Ferguson when she was in law school, and Thurgood Marshall's team pulled from it in 1954 in Brown versus the Board of Education. What a phenomenal, phenomenal woman. She was one of the founders of the National Organization for Women with Betty Friedan. She's Forrest Gump. She's everywhere, and we've never heard of her. She wrote a strongly worded letter to FDR Eleanor responded, and they struck up a friendship and hung out. In the Great Depression, she became a vagabond hopping freight trains. She was recognized as gender non-binary before that was a term. She pursued answers through the medical establishment, trying to find out why she felt like a male inside, even though she was born a female. She was ahead of her time in every respect. She narrates sections of her autobiography to us. She's dead. She died in the mid-80s. But the directors, they include time and content-appropriate historical pictures and video. The most famous interviewees are Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, and Ruth shows up. RBG herself shows up from the original interviews they did with her for RBG. My name is Polly Murray. I guarantee you is going to make waves in this country. You folks on this podcast are the first to learn about it because everybody's going to know about it.
Yeah, no, and it's on my list because it's virtual with AFI Docs for us this year. It's a little different that we've got different windows of opportunity to watch things. So whereas before we might both be watching exactly the same things, or we could only watch certain things on specifically certain days and times, we have a little bit of a more of a window. And so My Name is Polly Murray is on my list. Audible that you mentioned is on my list. Tom Petty is on my list. There are a couple other music docs that I definitely have coming up in the next couple of days. And so we'll certainly be able to go back next week. I think we'll be kind of doing our final wrap up of like what were our favorites overall, like what, you know, where we land in the end.
But you watched a film that should be on nobody's list.
No, it should. If you watch Blue Miracle, you might as well go ahead and watch 12 Mighty Orphans.
Oh, I thought you were going to do the other one. I was setting you up for...
Oh, you were setting me up for my other documentary. So I did watch another documentary called Daughter of a Lost Bird that, yes, at AFI Docs, that chances are very few people will necessarily see. It's sort of this Native American twist on the searching for the birth parents and cultural identity kind of narrative. In this case, it's this actress, Kendra Scott, who's doing the searching, and her friend is a filmmaker, and she's documenting it for like 7 years. The chronology was just kind of a jumble to me, and it started out really strong with like the first minute and a half, and I had very high hopes for it. But then it felt like a very slow kind of slog. It brings up some really interesting and important points about the efforts by the U.S. government in the past to sort of place Native American babies for adoption with white families. It's all white savior kind of idea. And how that can kind of undermine and erase a culture. And so I did not know about some aspects of this. And so that part where you actually learned something of interest, but I just was not a fan of how Daughter of a Lost Bird all came together. I just thought it was a bit of a mess narratively. But, you know, that's it's give and take with all of these documentaries. If you learn something, then it isn't a total loss.
So there's 77 films at the Film Festival. They're not all going to be winners, folks.
No.
The First Step, which will be on Netflix later this year, is about Van Jones. You ever heard of Van Jones?
Yeah,
I bet Hannah
CNN.
Has. He was kicked out early of the Obama administration over faux outrage from the right. But here he is showing up at CPAC. We know CPAC. It takes place at the National Harbor down there in Maryland. All the Republicans in the country invade National Harbor, Maryland. He is pushing a bipartisan approach to criminal justice reform, and he's doing it in the Trump administration because there's bipartisan support for this. The progressives are not behind him. They said the legislation does not go far enough. That's why he calls it's the first step. Let's just get a couple things through the door, then maybe we can get wider reform, wider sentencing reform, wider mandatory minimum reform. They call him an Uncle Tom. They say, how dare you work with Jared Kushner, Kellyanne Conway, both of whom show up in this documentary, by the way. They're back.
I don't want to go back there.
They're back. But there's a whole bunch of senators and representatives, like Cory Booker shows up. Really famous senators and representatives show up. It feels eventually like I'm just a bill here on Capitol Hill. You can see
Schoolhouse Rock.
Legislation working working its way through the system. And then there's the other side. Van Jones gets creative. He brings six people from South Central LA, and how the opioid epidemic is affecting there, and he puts them together with six hillbillies from rural West Virginia, flies them out, puts them all together in the same room, and they hash it out. I like Trump. Why do you like Trump? I hate Trump. And they go at it, but they find common ground on how opioid epidemic has affected both of their communities, and the South Central LA people are like, oh, if only you felt this way during the crack epidemic. But now that it's affecting white people, okay, maybe now we can work together on criminal justice reform, and they make sure to point out that disparity. The first step has names. Ooh, it's got name power, but it's not top tier. It's really not.
It's very hard. I had it on my list, my tentative list. I mean, when you have 77 films to choose from and you know you only have a certain number of hours to watch, it's really hard to choose. And so this year I really went with the things that I thought I might really enjoy on some level. And that was just not one of them because I'm just not in the mood for any politics and any reminders of politics past. Kind of moving forward, it's like, give me a little Tom Petty, Mary J. You know, I need that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's you're way ahead of the game from me on what you've been able to see so far at AFI Docs. I've seen about 4 things. You've seen 10.
I always change my mind about how I think in years past I've gone, I only want to watch what interests me, and that gets me in trouble later on because. Mm-hmm. Really, the stuff that you end up loving is stuff you never would have watched.
That's true.
Stuff you don't identify with, mm-hmm. which is so what I did this year was pick Newsies, Star Power. Like, if Van Jones is showing up here, yeah. If you go to the in-person, I'm not going to the in-person. I'm sure he's great live. But I just want to know what everyone's going to be talking about. And they're going to be talking about the first step.
And that's also a valid point to think about, you know, what AFI Docs in the past and what it will be in the future. I do miss that chatting in the hallways with filmmakers and chatting with other people right away when you come out of a movie, being able to feed off of that and have discussions, because that's really what these films are, discussion makers and discussion generators, and that's what they are meant to be. And so I do think that there's something lost right now until we're able to get back into that mode. So yes, it's great that you can watch a lot of these things at home and that they will be coming out and accessible to more people. But there's something to be said for when it's framed in such a way that you're going to have a discussion, you're going to talk to the filmmakers, you're going to hear the Q&As. And those really actually have always had a big impact on me after watching a film. So I miss that part of AFI Docs.
All right, I'm going to set you up for your last film by talking about another documentary.
Okay.
And it's called Courtroom 3H. And for our St. Petersburg listeners, for our Florida listeners, this takes place in Florida. This takes place in Tallahassee. In Florida State Family Court. A wonderful scene. It's probably right up there with divorce court. The camera just sits there and impartially observes over 300 individuals involved in family court proceedings. There's no back and forth. There's no questions asked. You're just watching life. You're watching a judge. At first, you're watching the most basic preliminary hearings and then into full-blown trials. You know, the first half moves fast, 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 fast. There are parents willingly terminating their parental rights. Obvious substance abusers failing at their court-appointed tasks. The Department of Child Services recommending courses of action. The second half doesn't go as fast. You just watch 2 trials. One is a man from Venezuela arguing against a petition of abandonment, and a mother fighting against the termination of her parental rights, even though there is a consistent history of aggression. The first half is awesome. It's so good. But the second half is rough. Are these really the most compelling trials? Are they? So it's a very interesting choice by the director. You know, you see family court in melodramas. We see them in movies all the time. But this is reality, and there's so many different cases and eye-opening, and there's some bad stories of the kids.
Yeah, but
bad stories.
Yeah, but I'll bet that some of that decision making fell to who signed releases on to show various stories. Because it's one thing to think you know to see a great opportunity and trial, and then you go to try and go, okay, are you okay if we show this in a documentary? And are like, no.
Well, names are changed. You can see. Mm-hmm. Like the court reporter saying something and they're saying a different name. And minors' faces are blurred. You can't identify them. But so if the person, they change their name if they want to.
Oh, okay. But you're still going to run into some legal interference, I think.
Oh, absolutely. But the judge, is in town. He's here at the screening, and he's a very compelling character.
And again, that's what makes some of this stuff more interesting, is I want to go see some of these people. If Naomi Osaka had shown up at an opening night,
she wouldn't have answered any of your questions.
That's true. That's the other thing to think about, is who would have spoken for her.
Well, but, speaking of orphans, I mean, people speaking for orphans.
Yeah, well, that's a painful stretch, because I did start talking about this one earlier when I ended up talking about the Indian adoption. But 12 Mighty Orphans is the only one on this list that is a in theaters now kind of movie, and literally in theaters. I think you actually have to go to a theater to see 12 Mighty Orphans, and it'll be better streaming material. We talked just a little bit last week or 2 weeks ago about Blue Miracle on Netflix, which was about a group of orphans in Mexico who win some fishing competition. And their guardian. Well, this one is basically about, it's another inspiring sports underdog movie involving orphans, but these are orphans at a home in Texas, and it's based on a true story, but I read that whole Hollywood real versus fiction, you know, true versus Hollywoodized kind of information, and there is a lot of creative license taken with some of the characters and the facts with this particular movie in terms of condensing time and amalgamating a bunch of characters into one to boost the tension. But it's about this group of scrappy orphans in wartime and depression era Texas who, with the help of this very devoted coach, defies the odds to compete with the big boys in high school football and go on to compete in the state championships, which is, you know, if you live in Texas, and high school football is everything.
Was this executive produced by Peter Berg?
I don't know. But I call it, it's Friday Night Lights with orphans in the 1930s.
Of course it is.
So if that appeals,
no,
and you like sports underdog movies based on true stories, even if they're stretched a little bit for drama.
A little bit.
Then 12 Mighty Orphans. It's just one of those, you know, inspiring stories that, you know, these people really did. The players and their backstory, that part is true.
Is it a faith movie?
No. So it's not nearly as faith ish as Blue Miracle was.
Give me Remember the Titans any day.
This is not quite that, but it does, it just does bring up the feelings of like Friday Night Lights, where it's all about this coach who, you know, who just gives up everything to coach these kids and just is a former football player himself, and he knows the value of learning the game. And they start with like out without having shoes, and they don't have uniforms, you know, they just play in like these inside out sweatshirts, and so
the Mighty Ducks didn't have uniforms.
These are the Mighty Orphans, not the Mighty Ducks.
Nice.
So you quack me up. So anyway, yeah, so 12 Mighty Orphans, if you like the sports underdog movie, this is in that wheelhouse. But I do think, and I think Luke Wilson plays the coach. It's got some names in there. I think Robert Duvall pops up. But it's just, you know, it's interesting. It's one of those, oh, I never knew about this, but people in Texas probably do. And anybody who knows Texas football will know the story from the 30s and 40s. So it's worth a watch, I would say, when it comes to a streaming service. I wouldn't run out to a theater to see it, because as we know, Charlie, there are some big movies out there and coming out there that Fast and Furious 9 we've missed, but I suspect if you're going to go look for some entertainment in a theater setting, you're going to do better with Fast and Furious 9, which we'll catch up with eventually.
I guarantee you Fast and Furious 9 is a good time. It just, you know, they're so campy, they're so cheesy, but I don't, for whatever reason, I don't hate The Rock and Vin Diesel and Luda chasing a submarine on the ice or flying out of high rises in Dubai.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me.
Somehow it gets away with being incredibly preposterous in what they do.
It's all about family.
But it always has heart. It's like, it's just this heart and a little bit of humor packaged.
And they're so overstuffed and insane. This is a movie I should hate. It should not be a Charlie movie. I should despise them. I don't love them. I just kind of like them, and I laugh with them. I'm not even laughing at them. I laugh with them.
Yeah, and I mean, if you liked 1 through 8.
I did, yeah. I definitely like some more than the others.
Yeah, but there, it's held its own through that number. The franchise is still going, and that's a testament to the character development that they've put into those films, because you still want to revisit the action and these people and this family. I think rather than 12 Mighty Orphans in a theater, go see Fast and Furious 9. Let us know how it is, and then you can always catch 12 Mighty Orphans at home.
And, you know, you've been to the theater already. I haven't been back yet, but I am going back next week. In fact, I'm going back to back. We got the big ones coming up. We got Black Widow coming up. And even bigger than that, we've got The Boss Baby 2 coming up. I'm taking Alex to both of them. So we're going to get the 8-year-old view as well as my view. His will be okay. He'll like them both equal.
Yeah.
But, we're getting back in the saddle of things. We're going back to the theater. Welcome back.
Yeah, well, Boss Baby was on network TV last night just to get people primed for the sequel. And I was sort of listening with one ear and chuckling because I'm like, oh, right, I remember that. I remember that line about the cookies.
Yeah, it's funny.
But whether or not it's, I don't think it's as big as Black Widow. So
TBD.
Yes, TBD. But I am going to watch that one at home, but then I will venture back into the theater for Black Widow. And we can't talk about that one for another couple of weeks, but Boss Baby, I think we do talk about next week.
We do, yeah. So. And we'll finish up AFI Docs, because we haven't seen the centerpiece screening yet, and we haven't seen the closing night screening. So we do have lots more to talk about. We'll tell you about Tom Petty, because I know everyone's aching to hear about that one. So stay tuned on AFI Docs Part 2. Will LFG remain the grand champion?
We shall see.
All right, well, thank you very much for tuning in to this episode of The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.